SB 5517, which is their budget bill, and Mr. Rocco has some information to present to us before we call the department up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm going to pass out a couple of items. There are actually four handouts. There are two responses from the agency to questions that have been asked, some yesterday and some from previous hearings, and they would like to review those with you. We have a letter from Representative Morissette regarding the LRAPA discussion on air quality, and we also have the response from LRAPA in the committee's request for additional budget information on their program. The Lapine demonstration slide presentation could not make it here in time today, so it'll be tomorrow. So if you want to see that, be sure to be here. And I would like to make one clarification to the materials that were discussed yesterday regarding the Lower Columbia River Estuary Program option package in the governor's recommended budget. This is option package 142, and just to clarify for the record that there are no FTE associated with that package, and it is a lottery funded package using Measure 66 lottery funds. And I think a summary of that you can find in your budget presentation book from of the department on page 57, and it should just say lottery funds. Okay.
Well, Mr. Rocco's passing that out. Perhaps you could have the agency come forward and take us through these two sheets of answers that we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and I will start today by going through the two handouts that Ken's providing you. The first one I will refer to is the one that responds to questions you raised earlier on March 22nd, March 26th, and March 27th. The first question was with regard to the vehicle inspection program and the turnover rates for the state staff and the contract staff. And there's a paragraph that just briefly describes what that is. The second question pertained to a comparison of the vehicle inspection program throughout the country, and that's actually an attachment where we've listed all of the states and what their fees are and whether or not they are contract services or state-run. We are still working on some graphic presentations for you on the fees over time and on the roll-up costs, and we'll work with your staff with regard to when it would be a good time to present those, probably next week when we're wrapping up some of those kinds of issues.
Okay.
You would also ask for more specifics about what is in the wastewater permitting backlog. That is also an attachment. It should be the last page where we have listed the total number of permits, the number that are individual, which are majors and minors, and the relative percentages of the backlog of those permits. The next issue was a question specifically from you, Madam Chair, about Orenco systems, and there's a couple of paragraphs in here on that, which basically, in a nutshell, says that the systems are installed in Oregon. I think the issue is currently there is a water pollution control facility permit required for those systems. As opposed to a quote-unquote standard system. They are somewhat specialized. And I think the question probably that's been raised to you are there any plans within the department to figure out criteria for measuring new or unique systems against the standard so they don't have to have a special kind of a permit? My response to that is in the memo that I shared with you in the agency overview about examining that program and further regulatory streamlining and customer service efforts in that program, that would be one of the issues that I'd want to look at, is what systems what are the criteria and or the rules that we're currently using that require some kinds of systems to have individual permits and don't require others? And how are we making those decisions? I don't have those answers for you today because it's something that I want to look into in some detail. But I do understand the issue, and that is the circumstance with Orenco Systems. There were questions with regard to sewer system connection moratoriums on several communities. The history of those is listed here, and the question was asked about that in respect to the City of Portland. The second handout that I gave you responds specifically to the three questions that were asked about the City of Portland, and I'll come to that in a moment. But on this current handout, I've given you a brief history on the City of Brookings, the City of Bandon, the City of Port Orford, and the City of Veneta, and how those evolved in our workings with the city. In general, there are a couple things that this explanation doesn't say. One is that three of those communities have received either money from the old construction grants program or money from the State Revolving Fund to help with those upgrades, so that part of the department is working with the cities as well. So far, the City of Port Orford has not applied for State Revolving Fund loan, but we anticipate they may do so. And in general, the way the process works is that when we have municipalities that are not able to comply with water quality standards, either because their old plants or need to be upgraded or there's been growth or whatever, that we do in fact work with them under a compliance order. And only if they are unable to meet the requirements of the compliance order after we have worked through that process for some time, do we engage in a dialogue with the city about a moratorium. In some cases, as you'll see from the write-up, it is something that the city works mutually with the department because they've been unable to get the folks in their community to support bonding, to support the upgrade, and they kind of ask the department for that extra oomph to help them do that. So we always try and work with the city to get there rather than just going out and imposing a moratorium. This is only after a long process has been gone through, and also generally will include the SRF funds or, in the old days, the construction grant funds. That's that question. The last question in this handout had to do, I think, Madam Chair, with your question with regard to land application of treated wastewater. And basically, I think the response Mike Llewellyn gave was that there wasn't a direct impact because of the application at agronomic rates, but he just wanted to get back to you with a little more detail on that. That's that handout. The other handout, as I said, I believe it was Representative Krupp who asked these specific, or perhaps Representative Krieger, these specific questions with regard to the City of Portland, the spill from their pump station. It was, as I said here, 22.5 million gallons of untreated sewage. There's a paragraph here that explains, as I said yesterday, we have not yet gone into the penalty calculation. This paragraph explains how the penalty calculation works, and there's an attachment to it that goes into it in more detail. And then there's also a paragraph that describes what happens with regard to backup, which in this case, it sounds like it was some miscommunication between PGE and the City of Portland. The only thing I would offer, depending on how our schedule plays out for the rest of this week and next week, if the committee wants to go in depth into a discussion of the department's enforcement program, I would be happy to do that. I would like to bring my enforcement manager with me, who is better equipped to answer the questions in detail, if you would like to do that. This is just intended to give you an overview of generally how it works in relation to some of the remarks I made yesterday.
Okay, any questions or comments? Everybody looks like they're poring over this information right now, so perhaps as they, questions and comments will emerge as they do that. And we would also have the option of bringing points forward tomorrow on these, too, that if, after we've had time to look through them. So what we're going to do here, then, is continue looking at the Waste Management and Cleanup Division.
Madam Chair, joining me again at the table today, and they will introduce themselves when the time comes, is Paul Sliman, who's the acting administrator of the cleanup side of the shop, and Sally Pent, who's the acting administrator of the waste prevention and management part of the division. We're in tab 6, and I left off on page 64, where I was just going to briefly comment on some of the accomplishments in the current biennium, and then go into more depth on each of the program segments in the division. One of the things on the list of accomplishments I provided to you that I particularly wanted to point out is the third bullet. As you may recall, last session there was quite a bit of discussion about the cleanup program at DEQ, and we have put in a lot of work this biennium with the stakeholders, and you had also asked about customer service surveys. In this program in particular, part of the work that they did in terms of responding to the issues that were raised last session was in fact a customer service survey, and they have made a lot of changes in the program in response to that. So I particularly wanted to call your attention to that bullet. We also have an extensive effort in the home heating oil tank program. We do have a policy package that I will discuss later on with regard to the resources in that program, where the workload seems to be increasing at a rapid pace. I personally am contributing to that workload with the tank at my mother's home, so I'm getting to learn firsthand how one works through a DEQ program. So far, so good. But there is, particularly because of the interest in property transfer liability, we get involved. Folks want to sign off that everything's clean in that program. We will talk in a moment about the underground storage tank program. We've talked a little bit about that already, but I do want to go into more depth on each of the programs and follow up on some of the issues that you raised yesterday. We also provide a spill. We are a responder to spills that have environmental concerns involved with them. One of them recently was the Yuquina spill. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I'll be talking more about our spill program. As you see here, we have approximately 1,500 spills reported to us annually, that, and some of those we participate in and some do not require our participation. And what I'd like to do now is just briefly go through each of the program components, the five program components in this division. Going back to solid waste, when we got into the performance measure discussion, we got into some of this, and I want to give you a little bit more information about the solid waste program. It is one of the oldest programs at DEQ. It started really in 1969. I think there was one person in the program, and it was at the health division, and then it transferred to the department in 1971. In 1993, the federal component of the state of Oregon took on the federal component of the solid waste program, and as you may recall, that was when a number of the landfills needed to be closed throughout the state. This program is entirely fee-funded. It's funded from two sources. One is solid waste disposal fee, and there are several components to that fee. And it's an 81 cent per ton applied to disposal sites, and then that fee is paid to the department to help fund solid waste program, including the planning and recycling grants that Sally referred to that we provide to the local governments for solid waste activity and also for household hazardous waste collection events. There are also permit fees that are paid. We do permit the private and municipal landfills in the state and conduct compliance activities there. Currently, there are 36 operating municipal landfills, and there are some other sources. There are mixed waste energy recovery facility. There is one solid waste incinerator in the state at Brooks, as you probably know. There are 45 industrial landfills, 124 transfer stations, 13 material recovery facilities, and 32 compost sites. So there's a variety of facilities managing solid waste that we regulate in the state.
How many FTE are in this section?
Let's see. I don't know if I... 46 FTE. And that's throughout the state. We're also monitoring 68 closed landfills, 43 of which have had leaks of hazardous substances. And part of that per ton fee that I described to you, 13 cents of that goes into a fund, an orphan site cleanup fund, that is dedicated to the cleanup of those landfill sites.
Stephanie, out of the 46 people that are involved in this program, how many of them are out in the field offices and how many of them are in the main office?
Do you know? I will have Sally Pant answer that question for you.
Thank you.
Introduce
you.
For the record, my name is Sally Penn. I'm the acting division administrator of the Waste Prevention and Management Division. And Chair Morgan, basically, I guess I would answer it this way. We have about 14 FTE in the headquarters office that do household hazardous waste contracts, put on household hazardous waste events, policy, rule development, market research, and then there are several more that are in agency that work for the solid waste program in other agency functions, which Helen, of course, will, Helen Lotchert will talk more about.
So there's so the seven people, and I'm not real clear on what they do, the seven people?
No, I'm sorry, there are about 14 people in the headquarters section.
And then what were you saying about
there are several more people that...
Several, she said several.
I said several, excuse me. I think it's about approximately six that do work in our, related work in our lab. Also in our central functions, information systems, human resources. But primarily it's about 14 in the solid waste headquarters and
Madam
the rest do field work.
Madam Chair, we can give you the precise numbers of how many are in each region if you'd like to know that. We do have the three
I'm
regions.
Real curious just how the department is organized with the number of people in it. So you know, a good visual for me would be an org chart of the department itself.
Okay, we do have in the agency overview.
I'm looking on page 80.
Okay.
But I'm not, you know, there's...
That's probably... this is just the way, that's the whole headquarters waste management cleanup.
Okay.
You want something that's more micro than that, is what it sounds like. Sure.
Is there something else in here that meets that?
Probably not down in the level of detail you're asking for, but we can get it for you.
Okay.
You bet. So that would be for each of these programs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Thank you.
These two graphics you see here, one of them we talked about yesterday, the lower one has to do with the municipal solid waste generation per capita and how that has increased, and Sally talked about that yesterday. The other, the top one, has to do with how we are doing on meeting the recycling goals. And we talked a little bit about that, but these goals were set in the 1991 legislative process, and during the 90s we have worked with the local governments to meet those goals to where 97% are now doing that.
How are we, why is this look so good and then the solid waste benchmark is so bad?
Go ahead. Chair Morgan, the solid waste benchmark is only measuring waste disposed. It has nothing to do, it doesn't measure recycled products. The purple or magenta chart in your on page 65 just measures the amount recycled. So there actually isn't a relationship there. And in fact, the magenta chart shows over the years, the percentage of waste sheds, which are generally counties, that have met their recycling goals that were established in 91. So it's really an apples and oranges sort of thing.
So this chart here is just, if you're taking all the waste sheds in the state, which as Sally said are basically the counties, and there's a couple of anomalies, this just shows how they are doing. Each one of them has a recycling rate that was set some time ago based on their ability to do it in part. So a highly urban center with curbside and things like that may have a higher percentage requirement than a more rural county where they have to have drop-off or there's no collection or whatever. So this graphic shows is overall how those waste sheds have done in achieving their own individual recycling rate. And so over time they've done very well, and it shows that basically 97% of them have been able to meet their goal. Now there are some, particularly in the more rural areas, who haven't been able to, and they have been in a lot of dialogue with the department and with others about whether or not those goals are realistic for those folks, whether or not they'll ever really be able to get there. Some of it is what you ask about when the markets are not there for the recyclable materials, or they are too far away to get material to market, or they don't have the right kind of mix. And there are discussions going on with the department right now, and I think with others. I don't know if legislation has been introduced this session to change those rates or not. Do you know?
I believe so, to actually look at new prevention rates for waste sheds. I'm not sure that, I think it's still in committee.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nola.
Are you suggesting then that the rules should be different between urban and rural areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, what I think is that we need to be realistic. And I think that the reasons that there are differences ought to be looked at closely, and the opportunity, see if there are opportunities to help those folks meet the goal that was set at the time was thought to be realistic, and why they're not getting there. And that at the time the goals were set, that kind of an analysis was done, pretty much almost by individual waste shed. And I think what I would advocate is looking at those again and see if they could do more, or if perhaps the goal wasn't realistic to begin with.
And Madam Chair, I don't disagree with that approach, but I think it's germane to the discussion we had yesterday about water quality systems as well, and that the specific conditions and issues and capabilities and obstacles and opportunities in different communities should be taken into account. And I think the department is appropriately doing it here. I suggest that they're also appropriately doing it through their commission in the areas we talked about yesterday as well.
I actually could add to that, Chair Morgan and Representative Nolan. Recently, during this past year, we convened it's called the Waste Leadership Policy Group, which was a representative of local governments and various industry representatives, and we actually looked out of that committee. It was about almost a year and a half long session. Out of that committee came recommendations for newer waste prevention measures at individual waste sheds that I believe that everybody will be able to live with. Everybody seemed to be agreeable. So I think we are moving in that direction.
Representative Hayden.
Just a bit of trivia for you. Just by happenstance yesterday, housekeeping circulated a memo to legislators' office that we were not separating the white from the yellow from the newsprint. We were putting it in the wrong bins, unseparated. And I guess you can draw any message you want from that, but one message is that we're quite willing to have other people do recycling, but the cost benefit to us doesn't seem to be too critical. we don't keep our own house in order.
Representative Hansen.
Far be it for the legislature ever to do that.
Please proceed.
All right, Madam Chair. As we pointed out yesterday, the per capita amount of waste continues to increase, and that will just be a challenge to us. And we've noted a couple of key things we want to focus on in the coming biennium to get an increased recovery of organic materials and also more partnering with businesses to prevent waste, and I would add businesses and government to that, apropos of the remarks by Representative Hayden just then. We do have a policy package associated with this program, which I'll talk about in more detail when we get into the policy packages. And there is, I hope that you have received a letter from the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association that they had sent us a copy of one they were sending to you in support of that policy package, which is for a manager for the region. Thanks. And I'd move on to the underground tank program unless there are further questions about solid waste or recycling.
Questions? Please go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Rock was going to pass that.
Oh, great.
That
okay.
You just mentioned out to us.
The underground storage tank program really has two components to it. One is a compliance component and one is a cleanup component. This part of the program I'm discussing right now really has to do with the compliance side, and that's the aspect where the federal law required the tanks to all be in compliance by December of 1998. And we have a policy package before you that has a fee associated with it that would, I believe, add a couple of FTE and continue FTE, and I'll talk about that in detail in a minute, because there is still a compliance activity associated with this program. And that's what this graph and on the, or this chart here, this pie chart is intended to show. The program did do a random sample of 54 tank facilities that had done an upgrade to make sure that those upgrades had been done properly and the tank testing was going on and those facilities were being operated and maintained the way they're supposed to be, so we wouldn't have leaks in the future. And they did find that 54 of those, and that's what this shows, 11% of the ones they looked at were not doing that. And so we are asking for resources to continue that kind of oversight. And another reason we're asking for that is that we are trying to get delegation of this program from the federal government, as we have with other programs. It's currently not yet delegated by EPA, and one of the things that's going to be happening that I wanted to alert you to is that in the month of April, EPA is going to be doing inspections similar to the ones that we did here, just as a field sample in a technical assistance mode. EPA is going to be coming in April in a compliance mode, and they will be doing inspections of underground upgraded facilities in the downtown Portland area, in Warrenton, Nehalem, Depot Bay, Toledo, Yahats, Grass Valley, and Milton Freewater. And Sally can maybe add a little bit more. I asked her to have her staff get as much information as EPA was willing to give us about, at least they are, unlike the CAFO situation, at least they've given us a heads up that they're coming, and they've told us where they're going to go. So it's very important to our stakeholders in this program who've worked with us on the bill and on the fees that we get delegations so that we can administer the program, so that we can go out and look at these sites ourselves rather than have EPA come in as they are doing next month. And that's another reason for the policy package.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are the types of non-compliance issues that we're talking about? There's some general patterns or something?
You want to address that?
Chair Morgan and Representative Henson. Largely, the noncompliance issues have to do with the equipment, the upgraded equipment in the facilities. This is what we've spent, you know, the last decade getting nearly all the facilities in Oregon up to speed with what's called leak detection equipment. And that usually encompasses some way to test the tank. There are a variety of different methods, but some way to test for tank tightness, also to gauge the amount of oil and fuel in the tank to determine if there are large amounts leaking. And one of the, where we're finding the most problems is in the line leak detector, which is actually mostly underground, and it's the line that goes from the pump to the tank, and that's where we're finding most leaks. In the upgraded system there, you test that. I'm not sure the details of how that's tested. There are different types of systems, but usually if it's properly maintained, if there's a leak, an alarm will go off. But it is underground, and people tend to forget about it. And that's where we're finding most of the leaks. I might say, since 1999, after the upgrade and deadline, we found 130 facilities with a variety of leaks already in, you know, about a year and a half time. So these inspections check to make sure that that equipment is maintained properly and that the facility owners are checking it on a regular basis.
How many, oh, I'm sorry, are you done?
Right. Yeah.
How many FTE are in this part of the program?
It's 33 FTE.
That would be statewide.
Statewide.
And how many of those are in the main office?
Main office now is about 5 FTE.
Five? And so what I hear you saying is that we have all these brand new systems that were put in the ground in conformance with the department standards and I would assume signed off by the department, and they don't work anymore?
Representative Chair Morgan, it's not that they don't work. It's it's sort of a good analogy would be like buying a new car, and if you don't make sure, the car works, but if you're not tuning it up and changing the oil, if you're not doing that, then you're going to have problems with it. And what we found is that many of the facility owners either don't know how to check or maintain the equipment, or they're not doing it. We would like to be able to help them with this and make sure that they know how to do it, train them, and so forth.
And Madam Chair, it's not in all cases. I do want to stress that this was just a random sample. We did find 54, so we know there will be some circumstances where, as Sally said, they either don't know how to do it or they're not doing it. And so we feel responsible to make sure, since this investment was made, some of it with the financial assistance dollars to help these folks, that everything does function properly.
So then is the problem that the systems are leaking, or is the problem that the leak detection systems are malfunctioning?
Chair Morgan, that's correct. It's that if there is a leak, there is no way to, the leak detection systems are not catching it. And there are a variety of reasons perhaps why a new system might leak. Perhaps was not put in correctly, or it is maintained correctly. I can probably get you some more information, I'm sure I can, on the reasons for that. But the systems will leak if they're not maintained properly, or if they can leak.
We can find out the specifics of what they found on each of those 54 sites. I think it's probably a combination of the things you mentioned. In some cases, they're leaking, and in some cases, the equipment just isn't working right. But we'll get the specifics on what they found and break them down.
It's very concerning to me that we've caused people to invest these huge amounts of money in these tanks, and they're already, I mean, they're brand new installations. And if they're already in places where they're malfunctioning and require maintenance, then that I think we need to question what we're doing here.
Madam Chair, we will find out. The other thing that I want to indicate is that in going around and checking on these folks, not everything that was found had to do with leaking. In some cases, it was just not doing the things that they needed to do in terms of checking or keeping their records, and in some cases, maintaining financial assurance, which they're required to do in case there is a problem. So it wasn't that every facility that was found had a leaking tank. There were other things that were found in the program as well that didn't pertain directly to a leak occurring.
If we could get some kind of categorization and summary, that
sure.
would be real helpful to know
We'd be
what
happy to do that.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Morgan, that's where I was getting at, kind of where you just went at the end. If you've got these things very recently in the ground, you know, equipment brand new, the first time you check it, you're finding things not working. How long has it been not working? Was it a week after it was installed? Did anyone check it from that week after installation forward? I don't know.
We can. Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, we can get you that information more specifically.
The other question that I have is, if it is a priority to have this program passed from the EPA to the DEQ, why can't you make it a priority within the existing staffing level?
Madam Chair, not sure I understand your question exactly.
Would it be possible to just reassign people's duties so that the whatever the education component that was missing here or whatever could be taken up by the existing staff?
The I'll get into this a little bit more, or Sally can add, but the Madam Chair, the funding situation for the program right now is it gets a federal grant of $351,000, and it doesn't have any general fund, and then the balance has been a per tank fee that originally was $30 a tank. It was then increased during the major part of the program to $60 a tank, and it was scheduled to roll back. The program has been working with the stakeholders on what kind of a fee would be acceptable. And we do have in your packet, we're kind of skipping ahead, but that's just fine, on page, my book's page 75, but I numbered my pages before this was final, so I hope it's your page too. It should say House Bill 2264.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, this is the governor's recommended budget included a proposal for a $120 tank fee.
And what's that fee currently?
$60. So it was basically a proposal to double it. The work that was done with the stakeholders and has been done with the stakeholders, the compromise that is being supported right now is for an $85 per tank fee with a $20 surcharge for 1 year, the first year, which would allow us to develop the rules to get the state program approval from EPA and to do some other stuff. I can give you a breakdown of what's in that, but basically we've been working for about a year with the stakeholders on a compromise for a program that they would support. The budget request came in at 4.64 FTE. And that is, see, this is what happens when we have to do things out of order. I have to stumble around here. That's policy package 130, and it's on page 416 of the big budget book. We asked to fund with that two existing positions, 2.34 FTE of our existing underground tank, and to add two positions. So if I'm understanding your question, you may be asking me, instead of asking for those two new positions, why don't we just take them from underground tank cleanup or take them from some other kind of activity in the tank program? Sally can maybe answer that in more detail, but at this point, I think the work that we have going on the leaking underground tank side is, we don't have a budget request for that program, but those existing staff are all consumed doing that work. So there wasn't really anybody in that tank program to shift over. So we had to ask for a fee increase to fund some of the existing staff, because typical of our programs, because of cost roll-up and the fee going, potentially going back, we were going to have existing staff who were not funded in the program, and then add two new staff to do this work because of these circumstances we've been finding where the stuff's in the ground and may or may not be working.
In the first paragraph of this fact sheet, it talks about how the annual fee was increased by the 1999 legislature to $60, but that there's a sunset on the fee.
That's correct.
At the end of this year, where the fee reverts back to the original $35 fee?
Right, that's correct. And this is the one where this bill has been, where we've negotiated with the stakeholders to not have the sunset, and in fact, to continue a fee at the $85 level to continue the compliance program, to not have it sunset.
Can you tell the committee, and I don't know if you even have this information, but if you do, what was the rationale behind having this the $60 fee sunsetted?
I can't tell you today. I'd have to go back and do some research, unless either Paul or Sally knows. But we'll find out. If you don't know, we can find out.
Do you know, Chair Morgan? I believe it was, and we will double check on this. But we worked with an industry work group very closely to come up with a $60 fee, and I think that was an agreement that the work group and the agency agreed upon, that it would sunset and we would review fees at that time.
Madam Chair, that is correct. There was an agreement reached on a number of or several fee bills regarding underground tanks last session, and this was one. And I think the legislature had some questions about whether that fee should continue at a higher rate if all of the tank work of having new tanks installed would be completed, then why would you need an ongoing higher fee? That was part of the discussion. But I think a reason for that ongoing fee are some of these issues that the agency's talked about today, about making sure that the tanks are continually maintained and monitored. And that was just part of the discussion last session, that had the sunset included so that it could be further reviewed.
Okay.
Just real Representative quick, Chair Morgan, Krieger. The $60 obviously was to give you the needed manpower back in the 99 for these dollars. What would the increase in people then that you got for that program?
I don't have that, but we'll get it for you. Back in 99.
Yeah. How many more people did you get with the $60? Increase to $60.
I think that's in my budget stuff. No, I think we'll have to check on that. The other aspect of this program that I mentioned, there's a cleanup side, and that side of the shop, which is really what happens with the ones we've discovered from long ago, the decommissioning process and the cleaning up that we're involved in. Paul's group is handling that, and we do have that part of the shop is funded by cost recovery, where we do work and then we cost recover from the responsible parties, and also by federal grant funds for cleaning up the leaking tanks, much like the federal Superfund, only it's for underground storage tanks. And then the third aspect to the program is, as I mentioned, the home heating oil tank program, and there is a policy package associated with that I'll talk about when I run through the policy packages. But that's really where we are in the business of helping to certify other private contractors who do that work. And it's when in a property transaction someone is wanting some kind of a sign-off from DEQ that the site is clean. The next program that I would talk about would be the hazardous waste program, unless there are more questions on underground tanks. I think we're ready to go. Okay, and Madam Chair, on all of these, when I put this together, I didn't want to overwhelm you with too much material, which is why you don't have the individual pages of org charts and budget information for each program segment within this division, but we will provide it to you. So I won't have it for hazardous waste or cleanup either, but we will get it for you.
Okay.
The hazardous waste program is, this is also a federally delegated program. It's the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which is the federal law, just like the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act. And Subtitle C of that federal act is the hazardous waste program, and Subtitle D is the solid waste side. This program has is mostly other funded, mostly fee funded. There is some federal fund and a little bit of general fund. There are several aspects to this program. There is what we call our toxics use reduction program that we operate in coordination with the state fire marshal to really help businesses do planning to reduce the amount of toxics they use in their processes. There is also a disposal per ton disposal fee on hazardous waste, which really applies to the Arlington chem waste disposal facility, which is the only hazardous waste disposal facility in the state of Oregon. There are also hazardous waste generator fees. There are three categories of hazardous waste generators. There are large quantity, sort of mid-sized quantity generators, and then what we call conditionally exempt generators. We have by far the largest number of our generators in the state are the least regulated. Those are the conditionally exempt, and we have about 2,800 of those. Registration of those folks is voluntary. We do a lot of technical assistance with them. And the regulatory focus is really on the larger generators of hazardous waste. We do have a few permitted what we call treatment, storage, and disposal facilities in the state. As I mentioned, the Arlington disposal facility is one. The Umatilla Chemical Weapons facility is one. And the storage of those munitions until they're incinerated. There are two facilities that Safety Clean operates that is basically hazardous waste recycling, and then Tektronix also has a hazardous waste disposal permit from us. We also have a special program for working with dry cleaner facilities that I think, was that last session or the session before? It's a
95.
Fairly 95 session. It's a relatively recent program that's really targeted on working with the dry cleaners on how to manage their spent solvents and try and keep some of that stuff out of the waste stream. These graphics that I have here for you is just to show, the top one shows the number of it shows two things: the number of hazardous waste generators, which is shown on the bar chart, and then the amount of tonnage of hazardous waste generated from 1991 to 1999 to kind of give you a sense of what the universe of hazardous waste looks like. And the bottom one shows the disposal facility at Arlington and what's happened there. And an obvious question that one might ask looking at these graphics is if your top graph shows that your generators are going up and your waste is at least staying constant, then why is it that your waste at Arlington is going down? The primary reason for that has to do with what is counted as hazardous waste. And one aspect of it that is counted that does not go to Arlington that is a huge percentage of the volume is wastewater. There, when you have industrial discharge of industrial wastewater that goes into a treatment system, it's pre-treated at the facility and then it goes into the municipal treatment system and it's treated further before it's allowed to be discharged. But at the discharge point from the facility, that's actually counted as hazardous waste. And so that's what skews the numbers in terms of the amount of waste generated. But waste disposed at Arlington is going down in general in the long term, which is good news for Oregon and in hazardous waste management in general. They do take some waste from out of state, so that's not all representative of just Oregon. But there is a Pacific Northwest Compact that limits where they can take waste from. When the statute was passed many years ago, that was agreed to by the facility. So basically, our number of generators has stayed constant. The wastewater is an issue, and what to do about it and whether or not it ought to be managed in another way is a big issue. And if you talk to municipal treatment plant operators, they will tell you that it is of concern to them. I mean, there are occasions where they have had upsets if something's gone into the system where it shouldn't go in, or a facility that they're accustomed to getting a particular limit goes over that for some reason, and so it is something that needs to have attention paid to it. The one comment about the, I said the program is mostly other funded, and a big chunk of that is the disposal fee at Arlington, so you can see as the amount of waste goes down, the amount of revenue generated by that to support the programs goes down as well. That's particularly significant for our cleanup program because two-thirds of that revenue that goes from hazardous waste disposed at Arlington goes into the cleanup program for cleanup of our sites. And so as that revenue goes down, the ability to pay for some of those cleanups may be in question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
But you said you ran those programs separately and independently, and it's generally been a principle of government that funds collected should be dedicated for the purposes. So if the people who are paying to dispose of waste are paying their way, why should they be charged extra to pay for cleaning up someone else's mess?
Actually, I'd have to go back, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, and look at how the original statute was written. Right now, the way the revenue, unless you know the answer to that question, but right now the revenue that goes at the per ton fee at Arlington is very specific, and I'm not sure if it's specific in statute, but it's basically two-thirds of the total revenue goes into cleanups, and one-third goes into supporting the rest of the hazardous waste program activities. And it's been set up that way for a long, long time when the fee was first established. Fee structure, if I get this, you guys correct me if I get it wrong, but the cleanup, there are different structures for different kinds of waste that go to the facility. If you dispose of a hazardous waste or a PCB, you pay $30 per ton. If you dispose of a waste from a cleanup site, you pay $20 per ton for disposal of that, or $10, there's also a $10 per ton if you have a high volume of that kind of waste, and there's a formula. I can get you as much detail as you might want to have. If a facility has already treated waste to reduce its toxicity, they only have to pay $7.50 a ton. And some sites, just for simplicity, will also bring non-hazardous waste there because it's mixed with their hazardous or whatever, and they only have to pay $2 a ton if they bring that in. So there has been, over time, since this facility was constructed many years ago and the fee was put in place, there has been a lot of discussion and negotiation, including the facility itself and including the regulated community, about what an equitable amount of money is to pay. You want to add something, Paul?
Chair Morgan, for the record, Paul Sliman, DEQ. The only thing I would add to Stephanie's explanation is that those fees are established in the law every 2 years. During the interim, we work with the facility managers at Arlington and other interested persons to come to some agreement about what those fees and the tonnage breakouts should be.
Madam Chair, maybe I'm not stating it clearly. It would appear to me that there would be a fee for dumping your garbage, for sending your garbage to Arlington to have it taken care of. And I thought I heard you say that some of those fees that are charged for disposing of garbage are being used at cleanup sites.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I understand your question. First of all, there are two sites at Arlington. One is a municipal solid waste landfill run by Columbia Ridger, whoever's running it now. probably lost track. And the other is a hazardous waste landfill that is run by Chem Waste. And for the municipal garbage that goes to the municipal landfill, there is the 81 cents per ton, and out of that, 13 cents is dedicated by statute, I think, to cleaning up old municipal solid waste landfills, and only that, no other cleanup sites. The fee that's paid at the hazardous waste landfill for disposal of hazardous waste goes into the fund to clean up other kinds of sites, industrial sites that have contamination from past practices. So there is equity in the way that money is used. It's just two different landfills, two different kind of waste disposal, two different fees, one category for solid waste cleanup, one category for hazardous waste cleanup.
Well, there, Madam Chair, there is equity of a kind, the same kind of equity as if we would charge the general fund to do this on the basis that it benefits all the people of Oregon. But it seems to me that I am being charged when I send my garbage to Arlington to clean up some spill somewhere in a remote part of the state that I had nothing to do with.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, on the garbage side, I think that is correct, that 13 cents out of the per ton fee goes into the fund that is used to clean up all of the landfills throughout the state, and your 13 cents that you would pay would be part of that. That's correct.
Sure. Chair Morgan, Representative Hayden, I think Stephanie has explained it accurately, that for the garbage side of the landfill, that money is essentially captive to solid waste issues and solid waste sites. We would not use that 13 cents a ton, as Stephanie has identified, for cleanup of a spill, cleanup of any hazardous substance site anywhere in the state. Where that 13 cents would go is into a solid waste orphan site account that would clean up an old landfill, for lack of a more eloquent term, that is leaking into the neighboring community. And the department has used that one time, and it's been a very effective use of those solid waste orphan site accounts, which is separate and distinct from the industrial orphan site account, which Stephanie will probably get to later in the presentation.
Well, Madam Chair, a specific example.
I think that this is like two ships passing in the
yes,
night.
Yes, a specific example. Some sessions ago, I felt that the fees for examining my dental x-ray machines were too high based on the service I was getting. I asked why they were so high. The fee was not just for inspecting my dental x-ray machine. It was for monitoring nuclear fallout from the Chernobyl nuclear accident. And there was no reason why I as a dentist should be paying to monitor that. Do you see the example?
Well,
you see what
I'm
saying?
That what I'm hearing is that the same situation applies here, that part of the fee that you pay goes to cover the cost of operating the dump that you're actually putting your garbage into, and part of the fee goes into a fund that cleans up sites where there is no apparent responsible party.
Which is not a dedication of funds.
And Madam Chair?
And I think, again, you know, that depends on how broadly. Representative Nolan.
Notice that Mr. Rocco has pulled out a volume of ORS. The most significant word I heard from Ms. Halleck was statute. And if there's a concern about that statute, people on this side of the table change that, not the people on that side of the table.
Well, Madam Chair, I heard her say statute, I think. So let's...
Madam Chair, the amounts of these rates and the percentages are set in statute. It's in ORS 465375 and in chapter law also. So these are, and I would also like to point out to the members that there are some rather good discussions of these revenue sources in the large budget book on pages 376, which discusses the hazardous waste disposal fee, on page 384, which discusses the hazardous substance remedial action fund, which also gets a portion of this, And then on page 394, the solid waste fees that go into the orphan site account. So there's a much more detail on those pages if you would like to look at that.
Thank you.
Please proceed. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rocco. I don't have much else to say about hazardous waste other than to point out that a significant program activity that I mentioned in passing is the regulation of the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Facility. And that facility is potentially going to have trial burns. It's on schedule, right, or it's scheduled for October of this year for trial burns. Whether they'll be ready or not is still in question. And I would move into the cleanup side of the shop here if you're ready to move from compliance and prevention.
I think we are, and again, I would kind of silently ask that we end up with an org chart to show us how many people are in this division and where they're at.
Yes, Madam Chair, we will do that. The one org chart we do have is in your supplemental materials in the set on page 79, but it does give the gross numbers of FTE and the sections, but what you're asking for is much more detail, and we will get that, and we do have that. Okay, the cleanup part of this program, and one thing I wanted to share with you, if I can find my piece of paper. We've talked about wanting to divide this program so that the waste prevention and management side is one division and the cleanup side is another division, even though they appear together in the budget. And we do have a policy package 134 that requests a division administrator position to do that. I did want to give you just a couple of basic numbers with respect to our request to do that. If we do have roughly 250 FTE in the combined program, and the way it would break out as we would hope to do it is there would be about 113 on the cleanup side and about 110 on the cleanup side and 140 on the waste prevention and management side if they were two separate divisions, and obviously if you put them together, it would be one. So the cleanup side of the shop is basically funded by cost recovery. It's also, and that is again when we do cleanup work and we cost recover from the responsible parties. The fees I mentioned earlier, the disposal fee at Arlington, which is called the Hazardous Substance Remedial Action Fund, two-thirds of which funds this program. There are federal grants in this program. And there is a little bit of general fund that helps maintain the spill program. About 90% of the program is cost recovery and fees from Arlington. There's only 7% federal fund and 3% general fund. This program is a state program. It was initiated in 1987. It was actually the reason that I came to the department, so I'm intimately familiar with the establishment of the program. When it was established, it was separate. And I think I may have gone over this in my overview, but it was a new program. It was set up as the Environmental Cleanup Division at DEQ in 87, and there was a Hazardous and Solid Waste Division at that time. When the agency decentralized in 94, because a lot of people were moved out of headquarters and the program activities were dispersed, the program was unified at that time. And what the agency has discovered in working with the program since then, and as was evidenced in all of the criticism, quite frankly, of the cleanup program last session, that putting those two programs together didn't work very well for the agency, that it was too big, it was too much of a management responsibility for one division administrator, and there were a lot of problems in the cleanup program last time for a variety of reasons. So one of the reasons we're requesting the package to divide them back up again is related to that.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Excuse me.
That's fine.
At the bottom of the page here, you say there's 350 new sites per biennium, which is about not quite one every other day, and you're working on 400 now. How long has that been going on? And at that rate, how long can you continue, do you think, to find new sites at that same rate? It would seem like you're going to end up with fewer and fewer as time goes on with the new rules about creating sites.
Paul, why don't you respond?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger. First, I'll comment on the 350 new sites that we learn about a biennium. Those come to us, as I mentioned yesterday, through a variety of sources, neighbors, employees, property owners. And most notably recently, those come to us as a result of property transactions. Someone is going to buy someone else's property, and before they're going to purchase it, the bank requires them to do some sort of environmental analysis. The 400 sites that are presently in our program, we have been able to manage that amount of sites and that workload with a very short waiting list. Working with our advisory committees, the term they use is, we don't want you staffed for Christmas. They don't want us to have a lot of staff so that there's never a waiting list, but they also don't want their sites to wait very long at all. So right now, we have a good balance of staff to address the new sites that are coming in, as well as those sites that are presently in the program to keep them moving along so we can get them out the program at the back end. That's why you don't see us requesting new project management staff for the cleanup program. One other thing I would mention is, of the 350 new sites that come in, it does not mean that every one of those new sites necessarily needs a cleanup conducted. The 1995 rewrite of the cleanup law changed our focus of the cleanup program so that cleanup does not necessarily mean you're digging dirt and moving it away to a landfill somewhere. It may mean some other type of remedy that keeps people, fish, other receptors from coming in contact with the communication. So I wouldn't want you to leave this with thinking that every one of those 350 new sites needs an extensive cleanup system in place.
The 350 sites, as you're saying, aren't all going to result and you having to do anything other than go out maybe for a land transfer, yes, everything's okay, and you fill out a paper and you go away?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, if you go out on a land transfer, you sit like for a bank before they'll transfer it, and so the bank requires the new landowner, purchaser, to get some type of certification that this piece of property does not contain a site or that it has to be taken care of. Not every site is going to have a problem, but you have to look to see if there is a problem. There's a lot less to do with that than to arrange for a cleanup.
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, that is in fact correct. I would say that that type of process is what led to a new cleanup program that we established about a year and a half ago called the Independent Cleanup Program, whereby they submit information to us as you've described, and we review that information and turn around. What they look for is what's termed a no further action letter, that no further action is needed on this site, and then the property transaction can move forward.
Is there a fee generated then by that individual inspection on that property for that person?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, there is, in the form of cost recovery. We're required to bill them for our time involved with reviewing whatever documents. Usually it's a series of samples that they've taken and the results of those samples and general characterization of the site. To give you a rough ballpark, we require a $1,500 agreement with the property owner as we review. When things go smoothly, we're able to give them some of that $1,500 back. When perhaps the site is more complex than they originally envisioned, through the cost recovery agreement, they pay us a little bit additional.
And this shows up in your budget somewhere, these dollars?
That is the cost recovery revenue that is part of the HSREF, Hazardous Substance Remedial Action Fund, that is in our budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, this is an important distinction. This program is different than, you've heard all this fee discussion about permit fees and the various other kinds of fees. This is a different kind of funding for the department. It's basically a reimbursement, a direct reimbursement for the work we do, sort of like lawyers, you know, who keep track of their time and do billable hours. That's in essence what this is. And so it's important to understand that distinction
from some of the other aspects. The analogy in like water permitting or air permitting, we haven't talked about it much here, but is what is referred to as receipts authority. And this is an authority that the department was given either last biennium or the one previous, where in our other permitting programs, for certain activities, we could, if somebody wanted to have a TMDL study done faster or a mixing zone study or something, they could sign a receipts authority agreement for the department, and we could do work and bill for it in the same way or similar way that we do in the cleanup program. The green permits program also works that way, where they pay us, I think it's $5,000 up front, I can find out for sure, but there are some places in the department that operate in that and in that cost recovery type mode, and it's a little bit different.
In the 350 new sites of biennium, are those commercial and industrial and government type sites? So I guess the question would be, are there are the home heating oil tanks in this category?
Chair Morgan, those sites would generally not be in this category. The vast majority of these 350 new sites are the types that you described. The government sites, the small business sites, large business sites that come to our site assessment program for some form of analysis.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just looked this up. It's actually worse on the home heating oil side. We actually get, at this point, there are 250 home heating oil tank leaks reported to the department every month. So there's a huge, and a lot of this is probably the vintage of my mother's. I mean, these houses, and she's long ago converted to gas, but we're getting ready to sell the house, and there's an old tank, and they went in there, and guess what? All that's in there is water. So, moving on to a little bit more discussion of this graph that we have here. These are the cleanup sites showing the completion of sites that the program has done. We've talked about there are different aspects to the site work. Orphan sites has been discussed. That's where there is no responsible party and the department is hiring the contractor and overseeing the work. There is the voluntary cleanup program, where a responsible party will not wait for DEQ to come out. They will come forward and say, we know we have a problem and we want to work with the department and get it solved. And then there is the independent cleanup pathway that Paul mentioned that actually came out of the process improvements that we did as a result of some of the problems in the cleanup program before, where if it's a very simple site and probably not a big problem, the person actually just goes out, hires their own contractor, the DEQ involvement is minimal. And so we try and take different approaches to getting these cleanups completed. We do have the policy package, as I said, that requests the an administrator for this division. We do have another policy package that is associated with a bond sale to generate revenue for these orphan site cleanups. This, as I think Mr. Rocco might have alluded to this in the overview, the bond sale for the current biennium, the 0103, is proposed to be covered by delaying the bond sale and then using some other funding that's currently available in this program. But beyond, for the 19 years beyond, in the general fund obligation beyond, that would be a point of discussion for this group on the bond sale. But orphan site cleanup is important, and there really isn't any other way to get there if we don't do it, and that's why that's in here. The final element of the program is spill prevention and response. And as I mentioned, there we get about 1,500 spill calls every year. We are not the lead agency, the emergency response folks are, and we do not have a lot of staff in this program, and so we are somewhat judicious about going out on every spill, but we do get a call and we do make an assessment of whether or not our involvement is needed. We have a piece of legislation which is in your booklet at page page 76, House Bill 2150. This has to do with marine oil spill planning. The spill program includes a marine component. It also includes going out when the tanker truck overturns on the highway and being part of the assessment of the environmental damage. This bill pertains to the marine portion for marine spill planning and also, I think, for the natural gas, some planning for the natural gas pipeline, oil pipeline, that comes through the state. And Paul's been working with the stakeholders. There is a fee increase requested to support this bill, and when I go through the packages, I'll talk a little bit about that. Part of it came out of the, since the new Carissa event, there was a work group put together to talk about what more the state of Oregon could do to be prepared, and this bill incorporates some of those recommendations of that group. And on this page, I've outlined some of the things that would be done here with regard to the planning and the participation by the marine industry. And implementing the new Carissa Review Committee recommendations. And that would be the end of the program overview, and then I would just cover a few emerging issues and go into the budget overview. The spill protection, as I said, the policy package and the piece of legislation, our issue with orphan site funding and the need to sell the bonds, the issue with the underground tanks, which we talked about continuing that compliance program and oversight of that program. We need to continue to work in our solid waste program to reduce the waste so that we can try and get the per capita waste generated down. And also there are new waste streams. The computer industry, obviously there are waste streams associated with that. There is concern that the waste tires may become a problem again if we don't help figure out new ways to deal with waste tires rather than just chipping them up and landfilling them. There may be some new industrial waste streams. We're starting to take a look at these persistent bioaccumulative toxics. Mercury, you've heard about. There may be some issues associated with pesticides. And so looking at hazardous and toxic substances is one of the department's strategic priorities, as you know, the water and toxics and involving Oregonians. And then I'll just move into the budget overview. Now, again, we did this on a macro level, and so you may also here find yourself wanting us to go back and do some more breakdown. We did it for all of Waste Management and Cleanup Division. So if you're wanting specific information on solid waste, hazardous waste, tanks, cleanup, we will need to pull that together and bring it back to you. But as we've covered, there are five individual programs here. One was not included on this list, but cleanup spills, solid waste, hazardous waste, and it should say underground tanks is the other one. Those are the five program elements. You can see by far the biggest chunk in the graphic is for the cleanup program. And I neglected to say when I was talking about the program, I said it is a state program. There is a federal component. There are some sites that are listed on the federal national priorities list, notably Portland Harbor. Also, the McCormick and Baxter site is a big one, and we get federal dollars for that. I included a fact sheet on McCormick and Baxter at page 82, so you could get an example of what is involved in a federal NPL site. So we do have some federal revenue coming into the state whenever there is a site listed on the national priority list. Page 83, sorry, I knew my numbering would at some point not match everybody else's. The next slide is the budget over time. This is the same one that we have been showing in all of our programs, which you can see, as I indicated, this program has always been heavily other funded with some federal funds. In 95-97, we had a little blip of lottery dollars, which was for the Underground Storage Tank Financial Assistance Program. You may recall that. And then a very small amount of general fund. We've never had much general fund in this program. One thing I would point out to you, in 91-93, you'll see a large other fund, larger amount, 71 $1 million. The reason that shows up so large is that there was a petroleum load fee that initially had been proposed and passed to fund the underground storage tank financial assistance program, and then it was found to be unconstitutional, and that went away, and it was the lottery dollars that you see provided there were what ultimately were used to provide that financial assistance. But that's why the blip there. I think I've covered most of this already. The other funds are about 74% of the total waste management and cleanup budget. Federal funds are about 23%, and the general fund is only 3%. The FTE overtime for the division as a whole, and as we said, we'll get back to you on the FTE within each program, has been relatively constant, although the mandate has fluctuated somewhat. We've had programs that we have added, and then there have been some program decrease. You can see in 93-95 there were some underground tank positions that were actually lost, and I can get you the history on that. I don't know it as we sit here. This page is just to give you kind of an overview of the various program mandates that have happened over time. And then I'll just go into the policy option packages if I could. Okay. This is, are we on 74?
Yes.
Yes, okay. We're back to the same page numbers. Starting with orphan site cleanup, again, this is package 133. It's on page 419 in your big budget book. And this would be a sale of $8 million in bonds for cleanup of high-priority orphan industrial sites. The bonds would be issued in 2002. And as I said, there's a debt service for 0103 of about $282,000 that we would be able to cover by selling the bonds mid-biennium, and also some of the other fund revenue would be made available in that biennium. But then there would be an ongoing general fund obligation for the debt service. And just a fact, little fact for you, that since 1991, we've had 48 sites designated as orphan sites where this revenue has been used. And if you have any further questions on the bond sale, I can get Paul to answer those for you if you have anything specific about that.
I think we're getting numb. Do you have any questions?
Well, I would say, you know, if this is to be funded, I think your funding source here would be appropriate. You say general fund, you also say a new revenue source, but general for the orphan site cleanup, general fund, and as we discussed before, I think probably socializing the cost of that across the entire spectrum of taxpayers is the appropriate thing to do, rather than, as we discussed before, drawing the fund from a user fee on some people who are not involved in the other thing. And even though we said that that was statutory, as you pointed out in the previous page, it may not be constitutional. Statutory and constitutional are not necessarily the same thing. So this should be pretty clean, financing that from the general fund.
With the existing program, the bonding program, when do revenues start coming back in from that?
Chair Morgan, we use these funds on orphan sites. Now, orphan sites are those sites where the owner is unknown, unwilling, or unable. So I can see you're nodding your head. I mean, we do our best to recover funds, but generally these sites are orphans for a reason. So at any given moment, we are working on a settlement or a purchase. I know you're familiar with the Formosa Mine site. That's, I guess, as good an example as any, whereby we use the orphan funds to do the work, but then work with someone else who may want to reimburse the department for our costs because they're going to purchase the land, or we may put a lien on the property if necessary.
Representative Hayden.
Well, that would be a wonderful way of paying for it if someone were willing to pay for it in order to get the property, sort of like a tax foreclosure maybe. But I was wondering, would there be any tendency on the part of a department when you find a site that needs to be cleaned up, and there has been a long list of owners, and nobody's really sure who caused the pollution, is there any tendency to go for the deep pocket?
Chair Morgan, Representative Hayden, before we even talk about a site becoming an orphan site, we do look to the liable parties, the responsible parties for conducting the cleanup, and we work with them. As Stephanie described, the voluntary cleanup program, we would approach the present owners of the property and say, we'll work with you to get this property cleaned up. Now, in the event that they do not conduct the cleanup, we might consider using some enforcement tools, although we do that rarely. Generally, they clean it up, or if they can't afford to clean it up, they submit some ability to pay paperwork to us. Only then would it become an orphan site because of their inability to pay for the cleanup.
Do they lose the property then?
No, not in all cases they do not. In many cases, we work with that present property owner so they can, for example, stay in business if they're operating a business there, whereby over time they would help the state recover its costs, or any variety of settlement negotiations we could work out.
But you didn't quite, maybe it's not a fair question, maybe you don't know, but if on a scale of 1 to 10, the probability of this poor person being responsible is an 8, but there's the possibility of number 4 that somebody with a lot of money caused it, do you work with the 8 or the 4?
Well, Chair Morgan, Representative Hayden, that's a good question, and the law is written so that all 8 of them could be liable for the contamination. Generally, we work with the present property owner. However, in some cases where the previous owner might have, as you described, deep pockets, we would work with them. Generally, that happens once it becomes an orphan site. And what you see happen most frequently is the present property owner, through the civil system, brings the other contributors into paying for their cleanup. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. There is some legal doctrine that I can't recall that where a group of people could be equally liable or
I think
individually
you're referring to
and
joint and several
liable.
Liability, which
yeah.
which is a
joint
fundamental tenet of the cleanup law, and it is a portion of the cleanup law that we could exercise if necessary. As I mentioned, in practice, we generally work with the existing property owner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you,
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair. I had a few dealings with some of these properties, both involved with Metro, and a lot of them are really, truly orphan sites. We had a situation, quite a few tax foreclosed properties in Multnomah County, where we had a tax collection department would foreclose sites with incredible liabilities on them, and one of the ways, is they'd be in the taxes wouldn't have been paid on them for 7 or 8 years. They go into tax foreclosure. The county inherits the site with, some significant problems and liabilities. And in trying to go back deeper down, finding out who was actually responsible, it becomes just an impossibility that those people have died. Their estates have been settled. There were bankruptcies, and it just becomes trying to find the responsible owner, whether they've got deep pockets or any pockets at all, become just an impossibility. And truly, truly orphan is a good word for them. Sometimes there were also some economic hardships that would be put on, somebody, say, involved in a chrome plating business in the 50s. And now they're 87 years old in a nursing home, and yeah, there's a huge liability connected with this property, but go.
The downside risk of turning them out of their housing to pay for
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and again, it becomes just real, real messy, and it's easier to call it an orphan site and proceed with a cleanup with some type of public financing.
Chair Morgan, Representative Hanson, just a comment. I'll just emphasize that's why we conduct the ability to pay analysis with the present property owner. We're not looking to turn someone out of their house or take their retirement account or their automobile or anything. As I mentioned, these are orphans for a reason. They've probably been through our other programs, either our voluntary program and just didn't have the funding to conduct a cleanup. And I'll mention another type of orphan sites as well, and those are area-wide problems you may be familiar with. Every once in a while, some contamination just shows up, and no one is sure of the source of it. However, people are smelling something odd in their drinking water. That's where the department goes in. And first and foremost, we make sure that people are safe, either through drinking bottled water or other systems. And then we methodically look for the source of the contamination. So that would be another type of orphan where it's not apparent where the source is, but it will require some level of investigation to determine it.
We're coming upon having to deal with the Portland Harbor cleanup, and from what I understand, it appears that the state's going to be responsible for the land, the work that goes on the land. Has there been any kind of an attempt, or do you have a timeline on knowing how many of those sites are going to fall into the need for orphan site cleanup funds? Are we anywhere near looking at that?
Chair Morgan, excellent question. As you pointed out, we are responsible for the upland portions of the Portland Harbor district area, I should say. And the reason that's so important is until we shut off the spigot, so to speak, stop any of those from adding more contaminants to the river, we probably don't want to do a whole lot of cleanup work. Presently, we have two sites in the upland portion that are orphans, and I believe we anticipate just a small handful of additional sites needing the orphan fund to help them with their work.
We could probably slide one more of these packages in before we need to close.
Okay, well, staying with sort of the cleanup side, the next one I would talk about is the marine oil spill preparedness, which I already referred to. It's package 131 on page 412 of your big budget book. It's $208,000, 1.25 FTE, which would be funded by a fee increase. And this is, as I said, it is House Bill 2150, which is just a couple of pages behind this. And that 1.25 FTE would make the entire marine spill program FTE in the department 3.35 FTE. There's not been any fee increase in this activity since 1991, and so we're trying to maintain the level of resource that we would need to run the program. It was 4 FTE back in 1991, and through inflation, it's rolled back to 3.35, and then if we didn't increase the fee, it would go back to 2.10 FTE. And Paul has been working with the fee payers, and I believe has support. That bill has been passed out of committee and referred to you all, I believe, for your consideration.
Would these be people that would actually be based somewhere on the coasts to respond to this house? That's structured.
Chair Morgan, the way it's structured is in each one of our organizational regions, we have one full-time person to respond to spills. And they wouldn't necessarily respond just to coastal spills. As Stephanie mentioned, for every maritime-related spill, we have half a dozen trucks that roll over, or trains that derail, or boats at a marina that happen to sink. Those three people are presently stationed in Bend, in Portland, and in Eugene.
But this says marine oil spill. There's no connotation there with oceans?
Well, the response people are in those locations that I just answered. The planning and a big function here is the planning for marine oil spills. We had a slide earlier that showed these geographic response plans. That's a planning component that's largely funded by the marine industry so that when they do have a spill, they know what strategies to employ and how quickly to employ them. And I guess that's a roundabout way of saying, where do they put boom in the water? How much boom do they need to have ready so that they can deploy it into the water? And then how do they start skimming or collecting that oil once they've captured it? So the three response people are not necessarily stationed on the coast. The planning people that work with the maritime industry are in Portland. Primarily, that's where the maritime industry is headquartered, and the vast majority of ship traffic comes into Portland.
And Madam Chair, just one point of clarification on the spill program as a whole. I don't think I mentioned this when I talked about it. There is actually a total of 10.45 FTE in the entire spill program. This is one component of it, this 3.35. There is also 4.5 FTE that are generally funded. Remember I said in this division there's a small amount of general fund. Mm-hmm. The bulk of it is in the spill program. 1.3 FTE comes from the cleanup fund we've been talking about, the fee at Arlington that funds cleanup activities. And then there's 1.3 FTE that comes from a variety of small sources, some federal funds, some drug lab cleanup funds, that kind of thing. So the entire spill program for the state is more than just the 3.35, it's 10.45.
Chair.
Representative Hayden.
They can monitor the oil drifting onshore from the new Carissa. It'll be useful. I have a question. Some years ago, a few years ago, time goes so fast, the Exxon Valdez had an oil spill in Prince William Sound. Was that right?
That's correct,
1989. Would these people, the marine oils, you probably wouldn't know, but I'm curious what the recovery rate has been. Was it the disaster we were led to believe it would be, or has there been a good recovery up there?
Chair Morgan, Representative Hayden, are you referring to the environment's ability to recover from the spill or the recovery of the oil that was in the water?
No, the animals.
That will clearly be, the answer to that will depend on who you ask. We do coordinate with the state of Alaska through a task force, just primarily for information sharing, because we have a lot to learn from what they went through. And of course, some folks that are studying the environment say it hasn't recovered, not entirely the fault of the oil, but the fault of the cleanup efforts that were underway. Some technologies were used in Alaska that involved steam cleaning beaches, which essentially inerted those beaches for a number of years. We've since benefited from their mistakes, and we use different technologies here in Oregon when we have contamination on our shores. Over a decade later, the reports that we hear are many of the beaches are recovering. Some of them aren't, but that may be due to natural causes, it may be due to the oil, or it may be due to the relatively invasive techniques that they used on any particular beach. I mean, at the time of the spill, the oil community didn't know a whole lot about how to deal with this oil, how to clean it up. Chemicals may have been used in other parts of the world that we didn't want to use here. And I think since then, Oregon really has benefited from Alaska's misfortune.
Good. Good answer. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're at a place now where we can adjourn for the day and pick it up tomorrow. Did you have an announcement, Mr.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to point out that that I think the agency is going to talk a little more about bonding when agency management comes up, because it is a significant issue for the agency. For example, for orphan sites with this proposed bond sale, they will have issued over $40 million in bonds, or have received that much in bond sale proceeds for orphan site work. And of the agency's $43 million of general fund, for the combination of the state revolving fund and orphan sites, over $14 million of that $43 million is to pay off debt on the bond. So it is a significant issue for the, not only for today, but in the future as these sales go up. And I also wanted to, I mentioned to Representative Krieger before he left on his question about the underground storage tank from last session. And if you look in your big budget book on page 5, there's a budget report from House Bill 2186, which is the bill that increased the fee to $60 and with the sunset back to $35. And it was projected that that would generate approximately $330,000 of revenue, and that was to support the retention of two positions or 1.7 FTE. So that was the reason for that increase to $60.
Do we know if that was indeed the revenue that was generated by that?
Madam Chair, the agency would have to get details on exactly how much the increase to $60 generated.
I would be interested in knowing that. And with that, we will adjourn today's meeting, and we'll come back together at 1 o'clock tomorrow and have a presentation on innovative septic systems.
Yes.